It's a lyric, again, with word selection and by word length, and it's for one voice, and it's called Range from 1964. Ball, bead, seed, star, disc, hoop, lens, yard, hole, shoe, slot, moon, room, bell, gear, mass, wood, dome, kite, hall, heel, hook, rind, skin, arch, cone, hill, knob, leaf, roof, door, lace, root, seam, chin, edge, gate, knee, mile, neck, nose, rack, shin, wall, fork, grid, horn, road, rope, tree, foot, pole, tail, wing, path, beam, cord, line, rail, wire. And again, this is using a kind of line length, which perhaps was apparent in the reading. And I've never been able to do absolute nonsense poetry. People may think that this poetry of mine is absolute nonsense, but I've never been able to use non-words or invented words or ersatz words. Other people have done that and attempt to make music out of language. But for me, my poetic interest in language is exactly the palpability, the tactile sense of the words themselves. And I've been accused of trying to treat words as things. Well, I know very well that words are not things, but words do have palpable, tactile qualities that we feel when we speak them, when we write them, and when we hear them or when we read them, and that's the real subject of my poetry.
And tell me, does that link up with your three-dimensional objects?
Well, the same person does both of them, indeed. All I know is that when there are words printed on the bricks, I always turn the words to the floor so the words cannot be read. All I can say is that the same person does both. And certainly my interest in elements or particles in sculpture is paralleled by my interest in words as particles of language, and in units which are different from sentences, grammatical sentences. Of course, words always have grammatical connection when they're placed together, if they're not nonsense words. But I have attempted to write poetry in which the sentence is not the dominant form, but the word is the dominant form. As you can see, there's a kind of split in the poetry, which is I've never really resolved, nor am I sure it ought to be resolved, which is between the visual aspect of the poetry and the sound aspect of the poetry, the aural, the A-U-R-A-L aspect. Poetry really was introduced to me as a child as sound, primarily. Even, of course, that's true with every child. The lullaby and 30 days had September, April, June, and November, the Memnonic verse, and so forth. But also, as I said before, about the visual aspect of books that I could not read, the books of poetry interested me. And I've only recently started to put the poems on the wall, that is, gluing Xerox copies of the poems directly onto the wall. And for the first time, I'm getting to see the poems beyond the range of legibility, which is a different question entirely. Of course, at that level, the words themselves function as if they were nonsense words, because you cannot read them. They're just too far away. My eyesight, at least, I cannot read them. So then they become a kind of pattern, almost as the poems were when I was a young child and could not read the poems. Now, I'm not at all saying that that is a desirable end. I would not, I think, compose poems of words where the words would just become patterns as they were in a painting. I'm not interested in that at all. But certainly the choice of words and the grouping of words has produced forms which have a, not an independent strength, but have a very apparent strength which comes from exactly the processes which caused the poem to be formed in the first place. Some of the poems are definitely meant to be sounded aloud, that is, the operas, and whether they're one-page operas or on to many pages is a long one, again from the conquest of Mexico. These have been performed privately, and a friend of mine in the state of Washington who performed with friends one of these operas pointed out to me, I think very wisely, that these operas really are not meant for anyone but the performers, because the interchange of the voices and the words between the dictions of the voices is not really so strongly apparent to someone listening to the performers as to the performers themselves doing it and being conscious of their own word stream counterpointing against another word stream. And I think it's absolutely true about that. I don't think that my work really lends itself to theater in any way. The last Saturday at Oxford at the Museum of Modern Art for the opening of my show there, I did do a reading of a work called False Creek, which is a 45-minute reading, and it's an analysis of a text of the life of a Canadian artist written by his mother. The Canadian artist committed suicide in 1969, and his mother wrote a memorial volume, which was published by Vanity Press in New York. And in that work, which is now exists entirely on file cards, I can't really imagine being done any way but in a reading. One starts with a large stack of file cards and reads the appropriate sentence or fragment and turns the file card over so that the large stack of file cards becomes goes from the unread to the read stack, so that when people see it being read, they can be sure that it's coming to an end. I think it's very important somehow with works that we can be assured they are going to come to an end. I find myself in going to performances in galleries and museums that they seem to go on forever. And one thing I rather resent about the performance aspect of art is the fact that one feels embarrassed to walk out on works like that, whereas physical art objects, paintings and sculptures and even these poems as they're on the wall, don't care at all if we walk away from them when we have lost interest in them. And I find a certain freedom with inanimate objects that sometimes is an embarrassment with actual performers. Performers make a much more intimate demand, I think, on our time and our attention, and we cannot bear to insult them by parting from them. But that's probably one reason why I have not been involved with the performance of works to a very great extent.
In the other room, you were talking about, you were interested in mapping poetry onto art.
Visual art, yes, in a sense. I, that's not a conscious plan, but you might say poetry classically, English poetry has classically been the mapping of language onto song and song forms, and we can accept that. That's very strong for the 17th century. It's with the 18th century, or perhaps with Dryden and his peers at the end of the 17th century, then finally with Pope we get a kind of poetry in the heroic couplet that is completely divorced from song entirely, and perhaps is mapped really on classical scholarship, which just coming then into the university scholarship was coming into the fore, and the Latin poets then became the model. But the irony of the Latin poets is that the English language doesn't have the same quantities at all that Latin has, so it was a mapping of one language, English, onto another language, Latin, that was so fundamentally different from English as if it were a different art form entirely, and forms like the heroic couplet and so forth emerged. Well, what my map is on the page, you might say. The page is an element, the printed page, the typewritten page, in some rare cases the handwritten page. It's the visual aspect, because I think most people read poetry silently to themselves, and very few people sing poetry. And very few poets I know are musicians. Of course, that changed also in the 60s with people like Bob Dylan and with the rock musicians, the Beatles and so forth, were definitely poets who were musicians and composed the music and the poetry practically at the same time. Leads of the lyric leading to leads of the song and vice versa, which was something that had, I think, been lost for quite a while in common English practice. But that's something which is pretty much closed off to me, is that I'm not musical. I'm visual or tactile. Even more than visual, I think I'm tactile. It's not the look of bricks that I like in my sculpture. It's their placeability, the fact that I can, as an individual, make a fairly large work by handling brick by brick and can do it myself and can compose a poem by combining words. If I can find the justifiable way to combine the words. And the justifiable way is not aesthetically justifiable in terms of a canon that pre-exists, but in terms of a convention which is sufficiently valid or strong to carry one from the beginning to the end, and at the same time assure us that the beginning was worth doing and the end was worth coming to. And whether I've succeeded in that is something that I will leave to others to decide. These examples we've been talking about now are fragments and attempts, and really represent different attempts at different forms. And that seems to be the state I'm in. I can't say that I have succeeded, but these are evidences of attempts.
What about your show at Oxford?
At the show at Oxford, there is a work called Still a Novel, which is on an incident in the life of Edward Muybridge. And it is approximately 97 pages long, and each page represents a kind of caption, as if a photograph had been taken by Muybridge of the event, which consists of his having shot his wife's lover and then having been exonerated by the jury for this crime. He was represented by the lawyer who also represented Governor Leland Stanford, the man who had commissioned Muybridge to take the photograph of the horse to find out if all the feet of the horse were ever off the ground at the same time. And this alliance of Muybridge, the photographer, with Leland Stanford, the patron and great financier and governor of the state and senator and so forth, managed to get him off in this rather dastardly crime, because he shot the man at night when he could not, when the Major Larkins, the unfortunate lover, could not even see if anyone was in the darkness. And Muybridge's claim, Muybridge's name of course actually was Muggeridge, he changed it in the course of his life to Muybridge when he was traveling from England to America, I believe. His claim was that he had not intended to kill Major Larkins, but only to maim him for life, and on that grounds he was exonerated. However, this 97 pages represents a novel composed more or less as if they were captions of photographs that had been taken of the events described. And again, that was a convention of our age, which is the photographic caption is used to carry on a narrative in that case. I don't usually attempt narratives because it's a kind of logical plot line rather like the sentence, which I think is very well burdened and I don't feel too comfortable with. But that one's definitely a traveling through, almost as if one was traveling through one of Muybridge's sequential photographs, except instead of the photograph, there is a caption. And that is more or less the structure of that. And there is also the color Xerox, which is a new process to England. I've used it myself in the United States recently, only this year, which gives a very strange embossed effect to color material. And the book, sort of scrapbook I did in 1960 called Passport, to which I referred before, is at Oxford in a color Xerox version, again pasted directly to boards on the wall. And I propose to give at Oxford and at the Tate, I think, in London, a narrative of Passport to explain why these pages were selected at times. They're from books and works of art and so forth. They were in my possession in September 1960, and for some reason, some unconscious reason, not any particular design, I just gathered together excerpts of things that were around me at the time, and they do reflect my state of mind at the time and things that I was interested then and perhaps no longer interested in now, and interests which continue, because I was then had reached the point of carving and sculpture when I had left carving, wood carving, behind and had started using separate elements. And it was a time of when I was going on to new things and leaving some old things behind. So Passport, in a sense, is a kind of my own visa stamp, I suppose, on my own progress as an artist and poet.
You seem to have a lot of interest in figures from American folklore that have currency, you know, popular heroes.
Some of them are popular heroes, but I think I usually get interested in them when their popularity is about dissipated. The fact that Lindbergh, for instance, is a perfect case of that. I don't think I would have been much interested in Lindbergh at the time of his great popularity, but he became a phantom of his own popularity. In the end of his life, he's recently died. He spent the latter part of his life devoted very much to preservation of wildlife, and I think finally he conducted himself with great dignity and learned very much not to make idle comments in public, ill-considered comments in public. And the causes that he finally did support toward the end of his life were the causes of conservation and ecology and things of that nature. I think it was exactly the state of this man after, you might say, his popularity had burned out entirely. And I am interested very much, perhaps coming from the city of Quincy, Massachusetts, which is unusually, as I said, steeped in history our European transported history. It's quite unusual for a place in the English-speaking New World to have that 300 years of occupation alone, and it intertwines rather closely with American history, especially revolutionary history, and with the Adamses going into the history up to the Civil War and the questions of the abolition of slavery. And these essentially deal with problems that seem to recur, but with the passage of time, the figures of the past have a certain kind of fossilized clarity, you might say, an isolation, which things of the present time, I find it very difficult to bring any clarity to my vision of the present. Of course, the clarity of the vision of the past is completely artificial and false, but that's what I can deal with. I think I find it very difficult to deal with text in the present, though some of these poems have been composed, or some other poems have been composed of texts from the present. The usual text is either an historical document or the document of my own memory in cases of autobiographical material. But definitely the past has always interested me as my own past personally and the past of that which I have known.
So the acts have almost become sort of archetypes, and though they soon lose their association or value in your work, you were interested, as you were saying earlier, in tactile qualities of words. They proceed from a point of being archetypes or...
Absolutely. In other words, yes, I may have unfortunately stripped these words of the associations which drew me to them to the first place, but definitely it was the associations which caused me to choose them, which is the opposite of the kind of random thing we were speaking of before. It's not by throwing dice that I arrived at these words, but perhaps if it now gives only the appearance of that, then it would be unfortunate, because then I would have defeated my own interest in the compositions.
And going on a bit to some... I think your attitudes about so-called conceptual art, which I think you feel very uneasy about.
Well, first of all, I am not in any sense an intellectual in the sense that conceptual art can be thought of as intellectual. My pleasure in art has always been the dialectic between the mind and the world. I think my temperament is such that it's much too easy for me to escape into mind or into idea, not on an intellectual level, but on the level of temperament or common thought, not in terms of organization. And so my poetry has allowed me to get away from reverie into concrete evidence of one kind or another. Perhaps the evidence is faulty or not well organized or unconvincing, but nevertheless the evidence is in the world, and it is a dialectic between my subjective mental states and the physical possibilities in sculpture of materials, or the physical tactile properties of language itself, again as writing or as reading or hearing, speaking. And it is exactly why to me art is not an art of ideas. An art of ideas to me is impossible for myself, and I think useless for myself, because ideas do not give me the pleasure that the dialectic between the mental state and the world state, that is what interests me very much. This passing between the two states, or the interplay between the two, but not ideas. As I've said many times, I do not have ideas in works of art. I have desires that I carry out or gratify to one degree or another, but they're not ideas that are realized in any Platonic or linguistic sense.
So your work is located almost between the two polarities.
Well, the only absolute physical state would be the world or the universe without man at all, because as soon as we are aware of something, there is a dialectical relationship between our subjective mental state and, of course, this is a delicate philosophical point, there are great arguments that there is no external state without the mental condition. I don't at all believe that. I'm a materialist. I'm sure the sun would rise if man were never born, but it is exactly in that area of between the subjective and that which is enclosed in the mortality of oneself and the physicality of the world. And that's why I've said that art is a branch of agriculture, because it's exactly what happens when man sets out to cultivate a field. He must have a program and an intention and knowledge and all this mental preparation in order to make the field grow, but he must have the seed and he must have the field in a fertile condition and he must tend it and he must plow it and weed it and then he must harvest it in its time. And that's an absolutely dialectical process, and I find exactly the same thing in art, which is between the states of memory and knowledge and the physical properties of the world. Dirge on Montezuma slowly. Mexico sides before day parts nothing enough. This cease city. Montezuma, grief, him, come, him, words, lies, terms, said, war, alive, die, him, people, war, Mexico, darts, arrows, them, him, lord, us, lord, name, Quetzalcoatl, Ixtalapalapa, through, dead, power, desired, before, them, duty, stones, head, leg, food, it, not, it, dead, him, soldiers, him, father, at, was, Mexico, person, subjugated, dead, Christian, wounds, him, lord, Quetzalcoatl, captains, dead, die, him, it, was, us, king, sons, Mexico, so, dead, city, dead, chieftains, prisoners, shoulders, captains, death, truth, stones, dead, him, this, ceased, fury, us, lord, idols, king, Montezuma, burial, stones, arrows, places.